America's Elite 13-14. Okay.
Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, white, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe,
gotta read them all.
Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe. It's only the best and longest running dedicated G.I. Joe comics podcast, in my own opinion, if not based in fact. If you are new to the show, you can find us over at our website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. We are continuing our look at the disavowed era with G.I. Joe America's Elite issues 13 and 14, which is July and August 2006, as the Joe Casey run continues. For those reading along, this is collected in 2006's America's Elite Trade Paperback Volume 3, which covers 13 to 18, or 2014's America's Elite Volume 3 from IDW, which also covers 13 to 18. Now, without any further ado, here is my co-host who will be talking about these issues with me. It's Real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hello, Tim. We're talking about two issues today, so hopefully we can fit it in a compressed manner, not doing four issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not promising anything. So where shall we start? Creative team is a normal thing, isn't it? We were brought these two comics by Joe Casey on script, pencils, Josh Meadows, and we talk a bit about Josh Meadows in our last episode, which was all about the Hunt for Cobra Commander, 25 cent special. Inks are Richard Zajac. Sounds like a Batman villain. And LeBeau Underwood. Colors, Jason Jensen. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. Military advisory from Phil Kost. And edited by Mike O'Sullivan. And in the credits as well, a special thanks to Tim Seeley and Robert Q. Atkins, indicating that they have helped with some probably last-minute art assists. Tim, shall we have a look at the front covers to these?
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
All right, the cover to 13 is Stefano Caselli, Daniele Rudoni, and Sean Dove. And it is a scowling Cobra Commander sitting at the Oval Office desk, or some kind of White House desk, with his hands up to his chin, or mouth and chin. Beside him is a bit of the American flag. In front of him, top secret folder with some G.I. Joe printouts. And behind him, through the window, you can see the Washington Monument. And
yeah, that's the thing that Spider-Man ran up the side of in the second movie.
There are other significances to that building.
I think it's the thing it's most famous for.
Well, you know what? G.I. Joe fans, it makes a couple appearances in Arise, Serpentor, Arise Part 5 from September 1986, the multi-parter miniseries that kicks off season two of the animated G.I. Joe, because Cobra attacks the National Mall in Washington, D.C. I'm not actually sure if you can see the Washington Monument or it quite like that from many or any window in the White House. but I'm willing to, you know, you also can't, there's no sound effects in space, and Star Trek and Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica sure would be boring. This cover, the colors are quite muted, and you know, Cobra Commander is not in a bright blue. He's in a gray blue. The white of the American flag isn't white. It's gray. And although light is coming into the room from the window, you know, this overall cover has a real dour cast to it. Considering it is not a loud, exciting cover, there is some there's a lot of intensity in Cobra Commander's eyes and his pose. I will note that Cobra Commander here has not printed out G.I. Joe data desk profiles for these Joes, because the Joe profiles are on regular white paper.
This cover could almost be a zoomed out version of the Hunt for Cobra Commander cover that we talked about last time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, even down to the fact that the Cobra logo that is stamped on the Stefano Caselli hooded Cobra Commander face on the cover of 13, the Cobra insignia itself is, I think, once again, horizontally squeezed a little bit so that it does fit. I think if you compare this to a sort of normal, quote unquote, Cobra logo on any G.I. Joe Cobra vehicle, I think the Cobra insignia is a little bit more circular and a little bit less up and down oval shaped. That's not a criticism. That's an observation. It's A-OK with me, because the human head is definitely not a circle. It's more an oval. OK, there is a variant cover to this issue 13. That one is by Nelson Blake II, Rob Ruffalo, and Sean Dove. And it is the image that made up the 25-cent Hunt for a Cobra Commander last page and inside back cover ad, where this is Cobra Commander standing amidst wreckage, brown and gray and dark, dark, dark yellow, in front of a Cobra banner that's flapping in the wind. And the way that this one is cropped, you don't see that giant red and white 13. But we recognize this image because for 3 or 4 months, there have been teaser ads that have progressed in the pages of America's Elite, where we start on that Cobra banner, we pull out to show more of it, we see it and Cobra Commander, we see it and Cobra Commander and the giant 13. So that art gets reused for this cover. And there's also a third cover. This one is the 2006 San Diego Comic-Con exclusive convention cover. And this one is drawn by, it's in very small type on the inside, Valentin DeLandro, Kevin Comrie, and Sundaraj. And I believe that Valentin DeLandro will be drawing some G.I. Joe comics in the timeline of Devil's Due right around now, correct?
You've got one on me there, Tim. I did not realize that.
Isn't this the person who draws some of Joe Declassified, the Larry Hama miniseries?
Oh, yeah. He does have, yeah, this person does have a credit on, Valentin DeLandro has a pencil credit on Joe Declassified alongside Pat Quinn, who was the person that I was trying to remember.
Okay. This cover is, once again, Cobra Commander in his new, sort of less formal jacket and more sort of battle jacket with pouches, holding a machine gun. We see him, we're looking slightly up at him. We see his waist up. And what's behind him? Is it sort of stone? It looks like snake coils.
Could it be like twisty sort of Amazonian rainforest trees?
Yeah. I think it's snakes, but it certainly fits considering where he was hiding and holding Spirit. So these three covers for issue 13, they're quite different from each other, right? Cobra Commander sitting behind a desk, Cobra Commander standing in a battlefield, Cobra Commander standing in front of trees and or snakes. You know, each has a different sort of color treatment and background.
And issue 14 looks very different again.
Yes. Issue 14 is a Phil Noto cover. He draws it and colors it. This one is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six people just standing and looking at you, but not all quite lined up in a straight row. There's a lot of variety in sort of how close they are to you. Some are a little closer, some a little further. And it is General Ray and five new characters who we meet in this issue that are members of Phoenix Guard, or perhaps we're supposed to call it the Phoenix Guard. This cover is, the sky is all sort of a muted orange. There's an American flag flapping in the wind behind them. No one is holding a weapon, but they all have grim determination on their faces. And on the bottom, it says, "The New Elite." And this is asking you a question because, of course, the subtitle of this comic is G.I. Joe, America's Elite. So you look at this cover and you're supposed to say, oh, no, these are the new team members, or are they replacing my favorite Joes? I think established Joe fans will recognize General Ray from the previous series. New non-Joe fans or really lapsed readers won't recognize him at all. But I think there are enough cues here that say, these aren't really Joes, you know, but they could be Joes, you know, like helmet, hat, goatee, you know, like sweater, pouches, straps. So you don't know who these characters are, but you know they fit in the world.
And that question, the new elite, it's also is hearkening back to issue one, where we were introduced to America's Elite for the first or second time, if you count issue zero, where there was a cover by Stefano Caselli, and this cover is directly referencing that cover. It's exactly the same composition, well, almost exactly the same composition. It's an slight artistic style difference because Noto and Caselli are very different artists, but the layout with the sky, the flag, the what are they, six figures on the cover, very much a parallel that we're meant to draw.
Yeah, I'll talk about this more when we do the Scarlet Declassified episode or mini episode, because that's all Phil Noto. But I will just point out here, Phil Noto's character poses and compositions here much more straight up and down, and the camera is looking straight at these characters. Whereas the Stefano Caselli issue one cover, there's more sort of diagonal in how they're standing and a little bit more twisting of spine in how they're sort of tilting toward the camera. And in that cover, the camera is below them and it's looking up at them slightly. They're all looking down at the camera slightly. But yes, I had forgotten. Good point. This is a cover homage or cover swipe back to issue one. Certainly on purpose. I'm sure that was an editor's idea, if it were a writer's idea, or the guy who owned the company. I don't know.
One of them big wigs. So let's get into the plot breakdown, shall we? So last time we had a prologue in issue 12, a two-page prologue set at the White House, where we found Cobra Commander to be this Scarlet Friedlow reporting to the president. And that is where the story picks up.
Plot breakdown.
In Washington, it is revealed that Cobra Commander is posing as the White House Chief of Staff, Garrett Friedlow, and has the ear of the president, who does not know this secret identity. Hawk ends his stay at Bethesda Military Hospital and returns to the Joe team. Acting on intel he supplies, the Joes attack a Cobra compound in Peru and rescues Spirit. Duke emerges from the Amazon, battered and bruised, but not yet well enough to pass on any message to the G.I. Joe team. In the pit, Snake Eyes is back in training, after his death and resurrection, but now in his commando togs. Breedlow is able to have General Ray installed as the leader of the new Pentagon-based strike team, the Phoenix Guard. Later, in Utah, the Phoenix Guard makes its first attack on Cobra, getting there before the G.I. Joe team. In Yosemite, the President and his Chief of Staff, Garrett Breedlow, visit the Joe headquarters and discover that the Baroness is being held prisoner. This is a secret that Scarlet and Stalker also find out from Snake Eyes. We close out these two issues as the Phoenix Guard begin to plan a mission to infiltrate the Joe base at The Rock. Tim, where would you like to start?
After we did a previous episode where we talked about issues 9, 10, 11, 12, you had this idea that maybe the last two pages of issue 12, you had a sort of a guess that maybe they had originally been intended for the beginning of issue 13?
Yeah. So my thought process was this. Those two pages, the last two pages of issue 12, were by Josh Meadows, who draws issue 13. And they very much set up issue 13. And I thought to myself, possibly the way that issue 12 finishes, it's very much a definitive ending almost. It is a close of the chapter. And you know, as a comics company, you want to try and make people want to get the next issue. So having a prologue leading into the next issue is a way of getting people excited and wanting them to find out more of the story. And then the sort of the third thought beyond the let's get people, you know, continuing reading the same artist, is that kind of the start to issue 13 does feel a little bit abrupt, like it is that you're almost missing something. You're seeing the reaction to what happened in the previous issue. And I think it definitely flows better reading those two pages together with the first page of issue 13. So, you know, I could be wrong. It's entirely possible, but it did occur to me as a thought that could it be that those two pages originally were drawn as part of 13 and were just moved into issue 12.
Maybe we would have the opportunity one day to ask someone who worked on these comics if that
if they was, can remember 20 years on. It's very specific.
So my overall reaction to these two issues is that I'm fully aware that Stefano Caselli is gone now. He draws the cover to 13, doesn't draw the cover to 14, and he's not coming back to do any interiors. And I think after the sort of mild thrill of the 25-cent Hunt for a Cobra Commander issue, I feel that loss again. You know, like, oh, this book starts so strong. And, you know, from issue zero and issue one, I thought, oh, this guy's not going to stick around as long as they or I want him to. He'll get snapped up by a bigger publisher. And Josh Meadows he's okay. He can tell the story. He can draw characters and faces and equipment and hands. I find his art a little bit, I think I used the term in a previous episode, overbaked. You know, it's a little unappealing. You know, there's something about how some artists draw where people are a little bit handsome, a little bit pretty, a little bit cute. I don't mean cute like, you know, Daffy Duck and Mickey Mouse. I mean, I'll just go back to that word, appealing. His art is just a little bit overwrought. And then that combined with coloring that's too dark, right? I have a note here, too much K, right? The K is for key plate, right? C, M, Y, K, cyan, magenta, yellow, K for black, right? So comics are printed with four colors of ink. And a lesson I learned from a friend who works in comics is don't mix K when you're coloring comics. because your colors will print too muddy. There are other ways to make a color appear darker than to just add black. In terms of story, I think Casey is doing a lot of things that I love the idea of, and I'm okay on the execution of.
Yeah.
So let me pass it back to you, Mark.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I think there's a lot to like here. I think the art is generally, you know, fine. It's up to the job. It's definitely not sort of up there with the excitement levels of Caselli, but yeah, it's all right. And I think the story, the kind of that threat of Cobra Commander is back. He's got the ear of the president. You know, he's sort of in this position where he can be a very different sort of threat to the G.I. Joe team is an interesting one. They've I think there was a sort of slight worry that the book was going into too much of ninja mysticism kind of land over the last few issues with all of the things that we talked about last time. And there's probably a recognition of that. And there's probably a bit of a mission statement here almost with Snake Eyes back in his commando togs, sort of making it clear Snake Eyes is back. He's a commando. We're going to sort of step away from all of that ninja stuff for a little bit of time. And so it's a sort of slightly different sort of story. And there's this new threat of the Phoenix Guard who, you know, cool new character, mysterious characters that it's a bit of a mystery to unpick. So that's inverted commas cool. There's still a bit of, is Casey quite getting the G.I. Joe voice right of how G.I. Joe works? And we'll get onto maybe a couple of examples of that.
So you just mentioned Snake Eyes as Commando. And I think it's worth pointing out, because I think maybe some of our listeners don't have, you know, the full encyclopedic knowledge of the toys or are a little newer to G.I. Joe. I think it's worth pointing out when Snake Eyes shows up in 82, the first action figure, right, he doesn't come with a sword. And he's in this costume basically that we see here in issues 13, 14. And his specialty is Commando. And then 3 years later, he gets another action figure, version 2. That's the one that comes with Timber. And he comes with a sword. And his specialty is still Commando. But by this point, 3 years into the comic book, there's story that establishes his ninja training, not just his Commando military training. And Snake Eyes has always had these two things. And so what Joe Casey is doing here, and there's a scarlet line where she says, is this in 14?
This is probably towards the beginning of 13.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Training.
It's in 13 where, yeah, Snake Eyes is training. And there's this idea that Snake Eyes is avoiding his ninja side, his ninjutsu training, or he has purged it. And that's interesting. I think it's a little gimmicky. I think you can do this. I think you can do it a little more organically. I don't know that, again, it may not be fair to sort of always go back to like, well, how would Larry Hama write this scene? But, you know, I can't, that's just sort of where my, not to say that Casey's getting it wrong, but just for the comparison, right? How about this? Instead of saying, how would a better or stronger G.I. Joe writer write this? That's not fair. How would a different and well-established G.I. Joe writer write this scene? And I think part of what you just said is right, that this is sort of a course correction and an over-correction and overcompensation for all the ninja stuff, the mysticism previously. But I think
it's almost not organic in the story. It's kind of looking at the audience and saying, you're going to get a commando Snake Eyes.
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah. I think you could do it very similarly, but just don't say it. Just do it. Like, don't even say, like, oh, you want to take some time off from ninja stuff, Snake Eyes? Just have him be a commando and not pull out a sword and, you know, don't show any red ninjas and don't, you know, show him, I don't know, climbing on a ceiling or something. I think Snake Eyes is actually the one who climbs up and down the Washington Monument in that Spider-Man movie. Okay.
in this sequence, there were a couple of things that jumped out at me, which I'll sort of pop out, which I'll just insert here while we're talking about it. First one, it sort of seems to imply that this is the first time that Scarlet has seen Snake Eyes' face since his resurrection, which seems a little bit unusual.
Well, how long ago in story time was his resurrection?
Hard to say.
I'm holding issue...
Not long.
So I'm holding issue 12, and she's a prisoner, and they... okay, so when he was in that red costume, maybe if we laid all the issues out in front of us, maybe it's reasonable, you know, well, she gets sent over here and he has to recuperate. But yes, I see your point that if he's recuperating, she would go see him. Or if they're flying back from rescuing him, she would, you know, run, you know, sit next to him on the helicopter and say, oh man, how are you doing? I'm so upset. You got programmed to be evil in this red costume. Oh man.
Yeah, could be they've come back from that mission in, or was it Mongolia? And they've been together on the plane and Snake Eyes, you know, he's not going to take off his mask in front of all of those people. And then he's straight back into training, you know, very dedicated mindset. And maybe this is the first time that they've...
All right, so help me with this moment where in issue 13, after his training, she says, second chances, if you really are back in every way that you were here before, then let me see you. And she's pulling up his mask and she says, there's a reaction shot on her. You don't see his face. She says, then the word balloons are really small to show that she's, you know, sort of whispering or saying it quietly. She says, oh, I didn't think that, oh my God, what did they do to you? And then there's a quiet panel from far away. He's still standing at the ready and she's hugging him. She's embracing him. So help me out with this, Mark. So Snake Eyes in the Devil's Due continuity, his face is fine back in issue 1 at the very beginning in 2001. And at the end of that arc in issue 4, he proposes, he gives her a ring. And then later he puts it aside and he goes on a mission and she cries a lot. Hi, Jay. And so where in the story was his face wounded?
So I think up to this point, we've not seen his face being wounded, or at least in any significant way. So I think as part of his death and coming back, the implication is that as part of this ceremony that has been used to resurrect Snake Eyes by the Red Ninja, that somehow they have done something to him which has marked his face. And I'm taking this implication to be that his face is looking unusual, looking, you know, scarred or some other thing that is, you know, is suggesting that it was not the almost perfect blue-eyed, blonde-haired kind of Snake Eyes that we had up before he died.
So Satan, when he's disguised as Chabang, a couple issues ago, in sort of resurrecting, reprogramming Snake Eyes, the implication is that he and the Red Ninja, now being sort of bad guys, do something to Snake Eyes' face.
Or maybe not necessarily because they are bad, but maybe as part of that ceremony.
I need a little more.
Carved in a hexagram across his face or
yeah.
Something.
So, you know, going back to that scene, I would want there to be a couple panels where, say, Tin, disguised as Chabang, you know, takes off Snake Eyes' face and looks down and is holding a dagger or a chalice with, you know, blood or wine or mystical potion, or, you know, they like throw him in a cage and they say he has to fight the, you know, the Red Ninja like dragon. He has to come out, and he like comes out covered in scratches or something. Unless this gets picked up later, I think Joe Casey is missing something here, or realized sort of after the fact that he could add something here and sort of, you know, like create a bigger moment here and sort of gut punch the reader. And I felt the gut punch, but then I immediately thought, wait, what did I miss? So I want some track laid for this before it. And I understand that in G.I. Joe, there's a little bit of a history of treating Snake Eyes' face being injured and fixed and injured a little casually, because in the Larry Hama run, his face is injured through issue 93. He gets it fixed in 93, 94, and he gets injured again in 95 when the DaCosta brothers and the Baroness throw hot ash on his face. I remember thinking when I read that, oh my God, no, you just, oh man, you just, oh, Snake Eyes. So.
Yeah, it's a checkered past, checkered face. Or maybe Scarlet's just getting upset about the way that Snake Eyes' nose looks in panel one.
Wow. Okay, so issue 13.
By the way, I don't always write down a lot of notes. One of my notes was, I don't like the way that Snake Eyes' nose looks on this panel.
Oh, this is where she's saying, this time, for a while anyway, it was real. Yeah. Well, while we're nitpicking the art, on the previous page, in the first panel, there are a bunch of horizontal lines to show bullets ripping through the stand-up targets with little silhouettes of people. But then in the next panel, Snake Eyes is throwing a knife, and that really wants some speed lines. And in the same way that, you know, after like Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns or Killing Joke, you know, after a couple like prestige grown-up comics in the mid to late 80s dropped sound effects, a whole bunch of people in comics decided implicitly or explicitly that comics sound effects looked sort of silly or sort of amateurish, you know, blam, blam, rat-tat-tat, swat, smack, smash, sock. And so a lot of comics after, say, 1987 don't have sound effects. And I think that's generally a mistake because it's a tool, right? This is not a movie. I can't hear sound. So like, tell me, show me what the sounds are. Similarly, motion lines and speed lines got dropped by a lot of artists because it looked sort of old-fashioned or comic booky, but it's really helpful, you know? Like, there are only so many ways that you can show that the Flash or Quicksilver can run fast, and speed lines or whatever you call them are a good way. And whether you do it here sort of behind the dagger or above and below the dagger, or, you know, like manga would treat it differently than Western comics. Maybe like everything is speed lines except for the dagger, or except for the dagger and Snake Eyes. Sure would like some speed lines there, because it sort of just looks like there's a, not levitating, but like a frozen knife in the air. And it happens again in these two issues when we see the helicopter. I sure want to see, you know, not the actual three rotor blades, but like the impression of the rotor blades moving.
Yeah, which, yeah, they sort of try and do, don't they? But the actual rotor blades themselves are very definitively paused at a moment in time. We went to sort of, there was a few things in mind that maybe another G.I. Joe author would write differently. And one of them for me was this thing with Roadblock as the pilot of the helicopter. The Roadblock is flying their main sort of transport vehicle, which is this helicopter, because Flint was previously doing that and has gone on, you know, leave or resigned or whatever. And they're sort of poking fun at him. They say, "You sure you can fly this bird, Hinton?" And to some degree, I think that's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek joke, but to some degree as well, it's like, maybe he's not quite up to the job. And for me, as G.I. Joe, part of that is that, you know, it's divided up into specialities. And for each speciality, you should have someone who's the best of the best. So even though they've got a shrunk down team, if they're, you know, on a helicopter, the helicopter pilot should be the best of the best. And there's a bit in issue 15 that we haven't quite got to yet, which makes this element almost accidentally particularly bad. We do have as an I Spy, we do have Ace appearing in the background at the rock, so it implies that you do have a sort of overqualified sort of aerial expert there. And in the rock they do have several Sky Strikers on standby, so while they're down to a small squad of member team members, it does seem like they do have quite an extended support staff there as well. So I'm not too sure, entirely sure if always the logic of the way that the team is made up completely makes sense.
Is that I Spy? That's not from these two issues. You're talking about the first couple issues of this series?
I Spy Ace in issue 14.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Halfway through the book when the president shows up to give Colton a hard time. Yeah, right when they come in. It's that second panel. Complete waste of time. How long are you gonna keep harping on this roadblock? I'm sick of hearing it. And then in the foreground is someone in sort of blue, light blue gray, and his helmet says Ace. Yeah, I think so. I have sort of a twofold response to that. One, flying a plane is different than flying a helicopter, so maybe Ace sort of couldn't have gone on this mission. Yep. You know, this reminds me of, you know, I see a helicopter being piloted by anyone but Wild Bill in a G.I. Joe comic, and I think, oh, well, Larry Hama would have Wild Bill piloting this, or Lift Ticket, because that's sort of all they do in Larry Hama G.I. Joe comics. And that reminds me of the Bench Press comics pitch, which was going to bring back G.I. Joe. This is about 3 years before Devil's Due got the license. This very small company, which did publish some comics, tried to get the G.I. Joe and Transformers licenses from Hasbro. This is about 1997. Larry Hama was on board. Ron Lim was going to draw G.I. Joe. And the internet has the 4-page sort of pitch that Hama wrote, Ron Lim penciled, Harry Candelario inked, someone colored, someone lettered. And in it, it picks up after 155, and the Joes come back and recommission the pit. And that lineup was only going to be, it's 10 or 12, I forget, Joes. And the idea is kind of like what has happened here with Devil's Due once or twice is, you sort of, you know, you have one person who's a specialist at this and at that and at this. And, you know, you have Torpedo because he's the SEAL. You have, you know, you have Wild Bill. Wild Bill is in that 4-page pitch because he's the pilot. He's the guy who gets them everywhere. And so I thought, man, this scene sure wants Wild Bill, either because Hama defaults to him or because Hama sort of, when like pushed to narrow it down, actively picks him in 1997. I also, in terms of the how would a different G.I. Joe writer write this scene, I think that one of the things that I think I have become aware of, part of why I like reading G.I. Joe comics by people who aren't Hama, is that it makes me realize what it is that Hama does. And he, in this scene, a Joe picks on another Joe, and it's sort of a joke. And then when they get back to the rock, that panel that I just read, where we happen to see Ace, Stalker, and Roadblock, are, one of them is sort of frustrated and complaining about the mission that just happened. And I think Hama doesn't write Joes picking on Joes. And I think Hama writes Joes complaining in a different way. And so I think, had Hama written this scene where Roadblock is flying the helicopter, I think rather than Shipwreck making it into a joke, like, are you sure you can handle this, Hitten? I think it would be Roadblock saying, ooh, I'm not sure I can handle this. Flying isn't my specialty. Or, you know, something like, well, when I think of heavy equipment, I think of my Ma Deuce, not something that weighs 80 times more and flies us through the air.
Hmm. Yeah, it's that sort of that technical specificity or sort of not, you know, it's sort of the loyalty and sort of backing up your fellow teammate, but maybe grousing a bit about the brass or about the you know, the administration above the, and all of the sort of red tape and that kind of thing. And I was thinking to myself as I was cooking dinner the other night about maybe what sort of makes some of Larry Hammer's writing different to some of the other writers that have tackled G.I. Joe is how you've got that very specific military components to it that he'll be dropping in, you know, the makes and the bores of the guns that they're using, and you know, dropping in the terminology like Willy Pete and educating us not only just in military components and sort of jargon like an enflammating fire or whatever it is he happens to be saying at the time, but also just drawing on from other things from history and words that maybe aren't in sort of common usage, and it feeling like there's sort of a level below that you can sort of investigate. And, you know, we do on this show talk about the colloquialisms and the some of the references that are being made in the story. And what is, you know, one of the things that's very different about a Devil's Due episode that we do versus a Larry Hammer episode is that for a Larry Hammer one, we'll always have a space where we're trying to explain a reference or talk about the meaning of a kind of unusual word that maybe we've only ever learned about from the pages of G.I. Joe, like defenestrate or something like that. Whereas we don't really get that from other non-Hammer authors.
Yeah. And if this feels like it's turning into like Hammer writes the best G.I. Joe comics, I like Hama's G.I. Joe comics. It's putting too fine a point on it. Hama's a smart guy. He reads a ton. He does his research. So a lot of the military stuff in G.I. Joe, it's not just because he served in the military. It's because 10, 20, 30 years later, he's going and buying books or magazines or field manuals and doing the research. And we could do a podcast about a bunch of Punisher comics or X-Men comics or Ninja Turtles comics written by all sorts of people who aren't Larry Hama. And we also wouldn't have to get a dictionary to look up defenestrate for those. So again, it's not like Hama's stuff is the best. It's that he writes in a particular way. And yeah, you do see that in other things he writes. Okay, so since we're talking so much about the guy who didn't write this comic, let's talk more about the comic that is and the guy who wrote it. So my final note for 13 is that some threads come with Duke and Spirit. Some threads come into issue 13 from the 25-cent hunt for Cobra Commander special. So I like that.
I got maybe slightly annoyed in terms of how I interpreted that Spirit kind of subplot, because I read it as being Hawk has come back into the team. He's given the team some intel. And they've gone out to Peru and rescued Spirit. And that made me think, has Hawk been sitting on this intel for months while Spirit has been locked away, and they could have done this much earlier?
Well, we in our previous episode where we talked about the 25-cent Hunt for a Cobra Commander special, you and I were talking about sort of when that comic takes place or over how much time that comic takes place, because there are four date stamps on Spirit's communiques, and then there's this amount of time that passes between the final one and on the last page when Hawk is reading it or perhaps rereading it. So for all we know, you know, the scene in issue 13 where the Joes go get Spirit, you know, maybe that's, you know, 7 days after, maybe that's September 14th and the September date that Hawk is looking at in the final page of Hunt for Cobra Commander is September 7th. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe as soon as he could get a little more intel and get the team together and like, oh, well, we don't have time to get Wild Bill, Roadblock, you fly the chopper. There, it all works out.
Yeah, I do feel like Spirit has been has been let down by Hawk by not coming back into the fold and trying to, you know, make it a more of a priority issue earlier. But I did have an observation from these issues, which is that it seems like we've got a common recurring kind of plot point, which is the Joes going out and busting a Cobra cell. I think it happens in issue 0 where Stalker is leading a mission to bust a Cobra cell. And then I think it happened again in issue 13, twice. Once when they rescue Spirit, and once when they get there too late after the Phoenix Guard have been there. And then it happened again at least two times when they were trying to find out the location of Snake Eyes. this a little bit of a plot crutch maybe if in doubt have the Joes go and attack at Cobra Cell.
Isn't this is because I mean this is so that Friedlow, who is really Cobra Commander, can say to the president, you know, oh, they're not really finding Cobra. They keep getting there too late, or they're only finding small cells. So is there something embedded in that actually is positively forwarding Joe Casey's overall plot?
Yeah, perhaps. I guess by the repetition, you've got this one where they get there too late, and then Friedlow is able to use that as an example of G.I. Joe's being ineffective. Let's talk about what we're talking about. Yeah.
Okay. So at the not the last page, but the second and third to last page of 13 has a 2-page spread of Friedlow, ta-da, with his hand, ta-da-ing, these 5 new characters behind him. And he calls them out each by name. And this is the kind of 2-page spread that, you know, an artist would love to draw, and it mm-hmm. might sell for more money, you know, the originals, if they go on sale.
Very splashy.
You have these 5 new characters, each with a code name. Code names are okay. I think one of them to me is like, this could be a G.I. Joe code name. And the other 4 are, well, this is any code name for like a comic book character, but it doesn't quite feel like the world.
Let's call them out. So we've got Friday, Halo, High Tide, Mech, and Snake Eater.
Yeah. So, you know, Snake Eater doesn't feel like it really belongs in G.I. Joe, which actually might be the point. In terms of costume design, you know, their colors are sort of black and white or dark gray and white. 2 of them have white tank tops. The rest of them are in, you know, so just black or dark gray, you know, like vests and pants and, you know, knee pads. Mech has this sort of red and black visor that like reminds me of, I don't know, like the Saw Viper crossed with, is it Slice or Dice, who's got the like purple, little vertical purple things in front of his eyes?
That's Dice.
Yep. Okay. The sort of like medieval, you know, knight with a K, the medieval knight visor.
I was thinking Prometheus from DC Comics.
Oh yeah, yeah, from the Grant Morrison Justice League from JLA.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe does he show up in Mark Waid? Anyway, you had these characters, and my initial reaction is like, ugh, 5 new characters. Like, you can't even, like, there isn't enough space for the Joes. Like, no, don't introduce 5 new characters. But Casey is definitely setting these characters up to do something, to be something. They have a little logo. They each have a little circle logo on them, which is yellow and orange. And it's the silhouette of a phoenix. And then above the phoenix's head, there's a little P and a little G. And then at the end of issue 13, added value, you get...
While we're on that page.
Yeah.
While we're on that page, I just wanted to mention as well that trigger discipline is not great here. We've got High Tide and also I think Mech. We've got their fingers on the trigger in the same room as the president. I don't think the president would be allowed in a room with armed mercenaries in the way that is shown here, but he's obviously an unconventional president.
I'm okay with that because
comics.
Yes, because I feel like no one in comics started talking about trigger discipline until I think like Larry Hama wrote it into G.I. Joe, you know, 2011 yeah. 2010. After the final page of comics, there are 3 pages of, it's not quite data desk, but G.I. Joe, you know, profiles with text and art for General Ray and Friday and Mech. And I don't quite know who drew those 3. Are they credited?
Ooh, this might be Seely.
No.
Friday looks a bit like Seely.
Maybe. I feel like these might be Drew Johnson. I feel like Mech and general. Anyway, so they've got names and specialties, and these are from the files of General P. A. Ray, General Ray, and he's written them in the first person. So he's saying, you know, this is how I know this person, or this is what I've seen this person do.
I thought that the General Ray entry itself was particularly nice, the way that they had redacted a huge amount of his sort of profile, sort of just continuing that theme of him being a real man of mystery and not knowing his past or what he did in between G.I. Joe and joining the Phoenix Guard. It's I like that aspect of keeping things a bit of a mystery. And yeah, having profiles for some of the Phoenix Guard is cool in the terms of, you know, only a limited amount of page space in terms of being able to fit in lots of stuff on each of those within the comic. So having a profile on these brand new characters is a nice way of sort of expanding it out.
Yeah. So issue 14 starts with the Phoenix Guard showing up, taking out a Cobra. Is it a cell, or they're trying to take out a nuclear power plant? And one of them has some cool little tech. The Phoenix Guard, codenamed Mech, has a little, looks like a tiny satellite. I don't know if it flies or drives. It probably flies, but maybe it's a bomb. Anyway,
it's a sort of bomb. Yeah.
So. I read this scene, and I'm supposed to be really excited about Phoenix Guard because they're cool, and definitely something's wrong because, you know, Spirit is warning vaguely about leadership at the end of the previous issue. And, you know, General Ray has this mystery, and all the Phoenix Guard, you know, they're mostly in black. And at the same time, I'm reading this scene, and it's not that long. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages, but I thought, like, no, get to the Joes. Get to the Joes. It's too crass to say I don't care about these five new characters plus General Ray, but get to the Joes. I did want to ask you a question. At the bottom of page 5, General Ray is holding, he has a gun, and he's pushing a Cobra soldier's head up against the control console. And he points the gun right to his head, and he says, "What are you snakes doing here?" The Cobra responds, "You're wasting your time." Do I know you? And then Ray says something that's a little dumb, but I'll accept it. He says, "Only in your worst nightmare." Notice the coloring in this panel. Like, there's a light source happening below the panel, lighting Ray from below. So I wanted to ask you, Mark, did he shoot this Cobra in the head and there's no sound effect?
Yeah, that was my interpretation of this, that they're not to capture the Cobra as anything. It's very much a take them all out, and it feels like what this panel is doing is, yeah, he's being illuminated by the gun flash as he's, you know, shooting this Cobra in the head.
Because two panels earlier, the light from the control panel is blue, not yellow. So it's two things are happening here. One, Ray is being vicious or aggressive. Two, I sort of wondered if there was a sound effect and, you know, someone at Devil's Due said, "Oh, take that out," or someone at Hasbro said, "Oh, take that out," or maybe if the panel was drawn a little differently and then they cropped it.
Maybe they left it purposely ambiguous.
Maybe they left it ambiguous. It's been half an episode, so I'm gonna pick on one panel of Josh Medor's art. If you turn the page, that old-fashioned helicopter lands and two guys are rushing inside with someone on a stretcher, and there's a panel where a bunch of like food and plates are something being pushed off the table, and right, there's a hand, and I think what's happening here is the two people have put the guy on the stretcher on the table and knocked the food and the plates and the cups and the utensils off. But this is a very strangely composed panel, and even though I know what's happening, I don't know what's happening in this panel. Like, I feel like there's sort of a 1, 2, 3 step if you're like putting someone on a stretcher on a table that has plates of food on it, and I feel like sort of three of the steps are all being shown at the same time here, but the plate is also in front of Duke. Yeah. So I sort of don't see the guy, much less the stretcher. So that's a weird panel. On the next page, what's Duke grabbing?
I think he is grabbing like the mouthpiece of an old fashioned radio, like a CB radio type thing.
Oh, okay. You can see it. It's really small directly above it in an earlier panel. Okay.
So Duke is out for the count somewhere in the vicinity of the Amazon. So he's sort of being brought to help, but not in a position where he can talk to the Joes and let them know what's going on with himself. So the Joes arrive at Utah too late. So the Cobras have already been taken down and they're finding bits of evidence to prompt some questions as to what happened. We've got spirit healing there. And then the president with Friedlo arriving at the Rock. They've asked to find out about what's going on with the Baroness. And obviously that's a secret and they are not happy about Colton holding the Baroness in secret. In the basement of the Rock.
You know what? Josh Medors does something great here. There's the wordless panel where the president, Friedlo, and Colton are, it's just their heads. They're all looking to the right. And Medors gives them all very different noses, which I appreciate. How does this scene work for you? This sort of the reveal and the Baroness not saying anything.
I think it's okay. It's interesting because they've all got sort of their different motivations. You've got Friedlo with his Friedlo hat on, but also his Cobra Commander hat on. You've got the president sort of not liking the fact that he's sort of being kept in the dark on such an important thing. And that obviously that playing into the Cobra Commander's agenda of him having distrust towards the Joes. You've got Colton who knows he's in hot water because this isn't really kind of the done thing to do. He also keeps it under his hat. He's asked how many people know about it and he just says himself and Duke, who isn't there, sort of keeping silent about Storm Shadow, because obviously I think that would raise more questions.
Lies to the president.
Is that the done thing?
I think that scene's great, by the way. Sometimes when I ask you, how does the scene work for you? It's because it doesn't work for me and I want you to say the negative thing. Or I don't understand the scene. I just need you to explain it to me. I think the scene's great. Something happens in the second half of the comic with Colton and the president and Friedlo and Baroness and the pages after where penciler Josh Medors is putting less detail into his pencils. So compare the two pages where Storm Shadow is talking to Chabang and then President leaves on Marine One. Compare those two pages to page two with the explosion and the sort of half splash of Phoenix Guard all, firing their weapons. There's certainly a lot less sort of happening in the color, but either because he's running out of time or maybe this is all about inking. I think this is about penciling. But Josh Medors is penciling less in the second half of this book, and I find it more appealing.
Oh, right.
When he eases off a bit. Fewer lines, because, in the first half of the issue, in the previous issue, in the Cobra Commander 25-cent special, everyone has these very chiseled faces and all these lines around their eyebrows and their stress, frowning, furrowing.
And it could be as well that we've got the special thanks to Robert Atkins and Tim Seeley. And these Storm Shadow pictures do have a little bit of Atkins to them. So it could be that this is where they're coming in and helping out, obviously, because of the deadline pressures.
Yeah. Okay, so on page 19, This is after you turn the page after Friedlow's looking out the window and this Cobra Commander mask is superimposed. So this very dark, too dark, nighttime scene with Stalker and Scarlet and Snake Eyes. So
I spy the hammer.
Yes. So the hammer shows up. Although, you know what? I believe this is not the hammer. I believe this is when the hammer is re-released in 2006 in a camo paint and called the Brawler.
Ah.
So it's kind of the hammer, but it's got a different name. But yes, so they've driven away from the rock so they can speak openly. And Stalker says, "I don't like secrets. What's going on?" And Scarlet says, "The secret is being kept from us. Snake Eyes, tell him." And then Stalker says, "Come on, guys. I don't think it's necessary to include me in the latest permutation of your romantic." And then the final panel on that page is him finishing. And he says, "Relationship." And I had to study this page to figure it out. So in the previous panel, Snake Eyes is holding up his hand. And it looks like he's crossed his thumb under his index finger, between his index finger and his middle finger. And I think what's happening here is Snake Eyes had just spelled out in sign language or something, "The Baroness is a prisoner in the basement of the rock."
Oh, right.
And that is way too much story that requires particular visuals for A, one panel, B, one panel that's cropped really tight, C, colored really dark, and D, on the next page, you get this giant panel of Stalker stepping out of the hammer brawler, not doing anything. I think the story beat there is that he's sort of reacting. He's like, his eyes are bugging out. He's like, "Oh man, whoa, that's a heavy load I was just given." But
and there's a nice splash full figure of Stalker, which if you were, say, Shane Simic meeting Joss Medels at a convention in around about 2009, you might decide to pick up that page of pencils. That's a very specific comment, Mark.
That is the panel that I'm referring to. So it is this panel where Stalker steps out of the vehicle. And I think the story beat here is he's thinking, "Oh man, what a revelation. We're in trouble. What do I do with this?" I don't actually see that in his face or in his acting. You know what I sort of see? I see a data desk pinup.
Maybe they can reuse it.
There's Stalker standing in a horizontal rectangle. I can just imagine three paragraphs of text next to him. Like, you know, he doesn't have his hands to his cheeks. His eyebrows aren't up. He's not turning away. He's not saying like, "Oh man." And, you know, you can write less if your artist can draw more. This is a good scene, but it really falls down here with this sort of sign language thing and then Stalker's under-depicted reaction. And so then in the next panel, he's walking away and he says, "She's been down there all this time and we didn't know. A few questions spring to mind." Like, I don't quite know what he's doing here. Maybe he's shrugging his shoulders. I can't quite tell. I think some of the acting here is getting away from Medors, and I think it might be that Joe Casey's script is asking too much of, you know, any one panel or any one page.
There's an interesting reuse of the panel three on panel five as well. It's not an exact stats because it's been
rotated. 10 degrees counterclockwise. When you say interesting, do you mean lazy and bad? Because
I was not projecting any
okay, you just find it
judgments.
Dear listeners, I don't like it when artists copy and paste panels or copy and paste and zoom in on panels. I think you got to redraw it every time, even if it's sort of a moment later where someone hasn't moved or all they've done is blink or they've just like changed their fist to an index finger pointing, you know, he went that way. It distracts me. Wait, let's go back to that page a couple pages earlier, the panel where I said that the president, Friedlow and Colton, they all have different noses, that wordless panel. Mm-hmm. Notice how in the panel before that, Medors draws the Baroness. Mm-hmm. And two panels later, it is almost the exact same panel.
Ah, yes, except yes.
We're sort of in closer. And I actually don't see any. I can pick up on any difference in her expression between the two panels. So I don't think this is a case where, like, she's cocked her eyebrow, or she's slightly, like, tensed the muscle under her eye, or she's cracked a little bit of a smile. But what does Meadows do? He draws her face again. It's not like a stat and a blow up.
Or possibly the Inca. Could be. It could be a stat that the Inca is re-inked.
I don't think so. Maybe. I mean, the lines around the eyes are different, and the shadow.
Yeah, I think it's some form of stat in terms of taking the original and redrawing it slightly.
Meadows might have just penciled this the second time.
I mean, I don't know for sure. Oh, actually, I could know for sure. I was on Comic Art Fans just a second ago, looking at Shane Simic's page. And on the original pencils for that page with Stalker, where I talked about the stat, it has that bottom panel with the zoom on his eyes has been left blank. So I think it has been statized and re-inked.
I don't think it's been re-inked. I think all the lines are the same.
You can see there's like, it's fairly small, but there are.
Oh, you know what? I take that back. Yeah, the.
And yeah, on the page of the inks, it is all inks.
Okay. Like, well, anyway,
it's got both of them side by side.
I think I'm seeing in the second half this issue. I think either some stuff got changed and Seeley and Atkins are called in to help with some fixes, or, you know, there are a couple of close-ups in the final couple of pages of this which feel like someone made some changes after the fact. Like on the second to last page, there's this really weird panel of Ray picking up the phone, and it's like, is he in bed? Is he sitting in a chair? I don't know. I can't tell what his head is.
He's meant to be in bed. I think the implication is in bed.
Where is the pillow? Is that a headboard? Is the maroon thing a blanket or his smoking jacket or his pajamas? like that panel is so similar to the next two. It's like, why not pull the camera back and show him in bed?
Yeah.
Anyway.
So Ray is disturbed in the night, presumably at home, woken up. It's your next assignment, mission code clearance password Napoleon, which is maybe a little bit of a weighted term, given that they've hinted that there may be some connections between Ray and Serpentor previously. He has to get to Phoenix Base, which is another base on a mountain. There's the whole team. They've got orders from In on High that they have to infiltrate and subjugate a classified facility. And they're pulling up the hologram. Is that what I think it is? And my question to you, Tim, is if you asked that question, what would your response be? Is it immediately obvious to you what that is meant to be?
Okay. So when I read this for this episode, I thought, I don't know what that is. It looks very cool and complex. It reminds me a little bit of the Boulder Mountain playset for Mask, which I know is not what it is, and it is not a reference that is intentional here. That's just, if you show me a mountain thing, I'll think Castle Grayskull, Snake Mountain, or Boulder Mountain. And then I thought, oh, well, the context is suggesting that this is the Rock. And then I thought, I'm pretty sure we've never seen the Rock sort of in full view or in full view and also cross section. And then I thought, I need to ask Mark what the hell this is, and if we've ever seen the Rock, the Joe Base, in full view and also kind of cross section view. And then I thought, man, I sure wish, you know, between the writing of the art or previous issues, like, this had been better established so I could. So imagine if the image here was an aircraft carrier and the number on the deck said 99, you'd say, I know what that is. Whereas, you know, it's like, well, the Joes raided a base, like a nuclear facility, and the Joes went to the Red Ninja's base a couple issues ago. And, like, you know, they just mentioned Rey has to get to Phoenix Guard, to Phoenix Base, and we're given a really generic kind of close-up view of it. Doesn't look like any, actually it looks like a little sliver of Mask Boulder Mountain, I guess. I don't know. So actually, before I read this page, this final page, when I was just, my eyes were just taking in what the pictures were before I focused on the word balloons, I thought, oh, Rey is showing off Phoenix Base. It's like, okay, soldiers, I want you to get to know where we are now. And then they're talking about going somewhere and like things turn sour. And I thought, okay, well, no one says they're going after G.I. Joe, but that seems to be what they're implying. So, Mark, my question for you is that the Rock?
Yeah, that's the Rock.
And have we seen
I don't think we've ever seen it in this format. I don't think we've had a cross section of view. We've only ever really seen like a mountain with like a big door on it.
Okay.
So it's sort of implied here, like in that last panel, for example, that there's a cross section where you see like little mini trees and stuff. I think the implication is that basically all of it is hidden undercovered by a mountain. So from the outside, there's not really much to it, but on the inside, it's quite a complex structure. I don't know why you need such a complex structure with 10 people. But...
Yeah, I wish there was two more things that could concretely affix G.I. Joe to this. You know, if we were sort of in closer and there could be some Sky Strikers and the helicopter that Roadblock was piloting, you know, or the G.I. Joe logo, which you wouldn't have in the base, or, and then I thought, okay, is the dialogue here too indirect? Does someone need to say we're going after G.I. Joe? And I appreciate that Casey is not holding our hand and Rey is leading us there with his final word balloon here. Looks like we're about to find out who's really America's elite. Like, oh, shoot, they're going after G.I. Joe. America's elite. That said, because this scene needed another panel, another page, some previous issue needed to show this base like this. I in that case, I think I do wish that the dialogue specifically had the five letters G-I-J-O-E.
Okay, so at the end of that issue, there's some profiles of the Phoenix Guard. So I think we've got Halo, High Tide, and Snake Eater, so three of them.
High Tide and Snake Eater definitely look like Sealy.
Mm, yeah.
Maybe that's what the special thanks is.
Could be. I think Atkins drew that Storm Shadow page looking in it. And did you read the profiles, Tim?
Am I falling down on my job as Talking Joe co-host if I say I skimmed them?
Well, because there was one specific thing that jumped out to me, which was from Snake Eater. He says, I have a nagging deja vu about the man that makes me particularly wonder if we've met before. He doesn't, you know, says he doesn't care for him much. And he also says that based on some phrases he uses and in some practices that he employs, I suspect that Snake Eater served in the French Foreign Legion, which makes me go, who do we know that served in the French Foreign Legion from the world of G.I. Joe?
Tomax? Major Blood?
My thinking is, could this somehow be connected to Major Blood?
But he doesn't have an eye mask.
Yeah, that's the thing that lets it down, is that, particularly in this picture on his profile, he is shown as having two eyes.
Well, let's go back a few pages.
And in the story pages, he's shown with these goggles, and you can see generally two eyes.
On the cover of 14. Well, covers are an exaggeration. Covers don't have to be accurate to continuity precisely on the inside.
We shall see. I think there's a mystery behind Phoenix Guard that we will uncover as we go along. And I'll call out for the record, no letters page on this one. I don't think there was a letters page on the previous one, and I don't think there is on the next few issues either. So
I just want to point out a couple little things for context. In all the previous G.I. Joe data desk profiles in the Devil's Due comics, under the new pinup and all the text, there's always an inset panel or two or three from a mostly Devils do, occasionally Marvel comic. This alludes back to not G.I. Joe Order of Battle, but the G.I. Joe dossiers that ran in the back of Marvel issues, starting with issue, I think, 108, you know, where there'd be a, like the pinup, the like Neil Adams Cobra Commander, or the Larry Hama Zartan, or the Joe Madureira Destro. And those had, you know, expanded profiles with more information from what the character's done in the comics, and then a couple panels from the comics, which alludes actually to Marvel Universe, which was the long-running 1980s miniseries, which had some updates. Is it update 88 and update 89? Where every page or two was like a new pinup with no background of a Marvel hero or villain, and then reprints of panels from when they had shown up in Marvel Comics. What I really like about these Phoenix Guard pages in issues 13 and 14 is that each of them gets a panel, but each one is a new drawing, because we have never seen these characters in Devil's Due Comics or Marvel Comics before. So there are no previous appearances to reprint here. The exception is for General Ray, and we have seen him before, and it's a Tim Seeley panel of him close up to, I forget who, some Cobra bad guy from, I forget, issue 39 or something. As a small detail, that's really fun.
I think it's from his first appearance where he was battling Major Bloods, and he had some coil troopers. So I think that black mask is like from a Cobra coil trooper.
Okay.
We haven't really talked about Ray much. What's your reaction to him returning?
Well, I think the bit of drama at the end of 13, when he's brought in at the Pentagon, and there's a line in 13 where Ray says, "All due respect, sir, isn't this G.I. Joe's jurisdiction?" And in one of these two issues, is it Stalker who says the same thing? You know, it's like Stalker has that line where he says, "We just got sent to take out some terrorists, and we got there, and they'd already been taken out. Isn't that what we do?" So I like the bit of drama that Ray is uncomfortable with this assignment. I think Medor's expression that he draws on the final page of issue 13, where Ray's looking at us, and he says, "Phoenix Guard, is this meant to supplant the Joes?" I think that's great. And then he shakes the president's hand. "It would be my honor, sir. Phoenix Guard will not let you down." So I think in 13, it's cool that he comes back, and Casey's got plans for him, and I'm on board. It, you know, in 14, I'm a little thrown off that scene that I mentioned where, you know, they kill all the... You're supposed to kill Cobras. That's what G.I. Joe does. But
yeah,
you know, the end of that scene where he definitely shoots that Cobra on the head point blank at the control panel. Also, what if the bullet goes into the control panel and the thing goes nuclear anyway? Like, Ray, talk about... what's the phrase? Talk about trigger discipline.
Discipline.
It's like, man, the end of 13 and the beginning of 14, like someone put a child lock on these guns.
It's a bit of a turn because, you know, Ray has been presented as quite the all-American hero, and, you know, sort of, you know, the Joes are skeptical of him. And by the end of that Jawa run, he'd kind of shown that he had the stuff and, you know, could be as good a leader as any. So and you know, he's initially shown here as having that hesitancy about supplanting the Joes. So the 14 sort of descent into darkness seems a little bit extreme.
I do just want to tip my hat to penciler Josh Medors and color artist Jason Jensen in these two issues for getting Ray's hair under control. Ray's hair always looked funny to me in the Brandon Jerwa issues, and I forget who was coloring those, but it sort of looked kind of like a helmet and too shiny and too flat, and it works here. And you know, Phil Noto gets it right on the cover to 14. So how do you feel about Ray? I didn't like him in the earlier run, and he's got such, I don't know what the angle is, but he's got such an angle here, and he's not taking over the team and pushing aside an established character like, you know, Hawk or Duke or Colton, that it's not like there's too much of him all at once here. So, Mark, what do you think of Ray showing up here?
Yeah, no, I think you've kind of summarized it well. I think some of his handling in the previous issues wasn't necessarily the best, you know, a bit too much, too quick, and sort of trying to figure out what was the point of him, and, you know, is he a bit too much of a sort of superhero? But here he's come in and he's handled in a bit more of a grounded way, and given that he was such an important part of those last few issues of the previous run, it's kind of good that he's not just been put away and forgotten about, because there was still sort of open questions about him. So I think it's particularly with the space now at issue 13 with his return, you know, there's been a bit of breathing room when he's not there, so there's a bit of a sense of expectation for his return and what does it mean. So I think it's a welcome addition. I like it.
I wonder, you know, there are stories in comics, I think more Marvel that I know of than other publishers, where a writer on a long-running series introduces a character or has a change in mind for an established character and doesn't get to do with that character what they were going to, and then the next writer maybe ignores that character or maybe does something with that character, but it's sort of what they want to do with the character, not mm-hmm. what the first writer intended. You know, I'm thinking of Chris Claremont and X-Men. You know, Claremont set up Gambit with a particular arc, and then Claremont left X-Men before he got to sort of do that thing, and then it was up to, I think, Scott Lobdell, like 50 issues later, to sort of kind of do that with Gambit. Or, you know, Claremont was going to like have all this stuff happen with Wolverine and Sabretooth right before he left, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wonder if whatever Joe Casey is doing with General Ray here a year into America's Elite, how much that jives with what Jirwa and Blaylock had in mind a year or two earlier. I wonder if, you know, besides the disappointment of not getting to write more G.I. Joe, you know, if we were to ask someone like Brandon Jirwa, it's like, oh, the stuff that did happen with Ray after you weren't writing the book, like, what do you think of that? Or is that close to what you were going to do? Sort of, I'm less interested in what a writer no longer doing the book thinks, because maybe it's just all disappointment, right? Or like, no, I don't read G.I. Joe after I'm not writing G.I. Joe. Maybe my question is, I wonder who the custodian of the character is, if it sort of falls back on Blaylock or Mike Sullivan, you know, like, I own the company, or, well, I'm the editor and I know what the intention was. Hey, new writer, this is what you should do with this character. How you get there, how long it takes is kind of up to you. Or if it's Casey just making up some new stuff, you know, like, oh, actually, General Ray, he's the one who sold out the Morlocks to Mr. Sinister. He's responsible for the massacre in Uncanny X-Men.
Probably. Should we give this a rating?
Yo, cola, not grape soda.
It's Yo, Joe-age time.
I'll probably stick to a 7 on this one again. Art is fine, solid. I like the mystery about, I like the political machinations with Cobra Commander. I like the sort of the horror aspect of that sort of mask that he was wearing, the human face mask in the very beginning of issue 13. Snake Eyes returning to commando mode is going to be quite cool. General Ray, yet felt unfinished, and I'm glad to see his return. This new team that they're setting up, the Phoenix Guard, is suggesting sort of an interesting plot and sort of this cool new set of antagonists. So yeah, I think generally a lot to like in these two issues. So yeah, quite happy with that, and looking forward to where it's going next. And generally, you can tell when I'm excited about the issues because I want to read ahead. And I definitely want to read ahead at the moment. Tim?
Give it a 5. It's okay. For everything that works or looks good, there's something that doesn't quite work or is confusing or doesn't look good.
Okay, so that's us done with 13 and 14. Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will be continuing our look at America's Elite with issues 15 through 18. That is the last four issues of the Joe Casey run. So we'll be doing those at a little bit of a running pace. And then I'm sure we'll be covering other things as we go along, expectation of the Skybound upcoming releases. A return to A-Rar, Duke, Cobra Commander, hurrah! Anything to close out, Tim?
You close that out well.
So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick-and-mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers, Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.